from Slightly Unbalanced. We are still Queer as Folk. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Today we're talking about episode 8 of season 4, and it's called Two Kinds of Lies.
It first aired in the U.S. on June 6, 2004. It was written by Del Shores and showrunners Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman.
Two Kinds of Lies was directed by Bruce McDonald, my personal favorite director. He did 8 episodes of Queer as Folk, and alas, this is his last one. He's still very much an active director, though, mostly in Canadian television.
Canada. Here's the synopsis of Two Kinds of Lies. Brian begins a slow recovery after having his left testicle removed, forcing Justin and Michael to decide whether to tip off Brian that they know about it or to let him suffer alone without the support of his loved ones.
Debbie continues to mourn the loss of Vic by buying a $47,000 tombstone, all while being unable to return to work at the Liberty Diner, leaving Justin in charge, much to the consternation of every gay man ordering greasy food in Pittsburgh.
Who do you gotta fuck to get service around here?
That guy was harsh.
I mean, like, brutal.
Elsewhere, Lindsay sketches a naked Sam Auerbach holding a cigar.
Ugh.
And Melanie is oblivious to his aggressive and creepy pursuit of Lindsay.
Justin and Michael meet a new character, Brett Keller, Hollywood director, who wants to option the Rage comic book into a feature film, much to the Ben's jealous consternation.
Ben always seems like upset about something. I just remember the original Ben when he first came into the show, when he was like very zen and living in
Buddhist.
The now. And yeah, and he was writing books. And now he's just like very jaded and like upset with the world.
It's kind of like social justice warrior before it was a real phrase, you know? I'm sure we'll get into it when we go further into the episode, but that was the vibe I was getting.
Well, he did become he became that community leader also. Remember when he and Melanie were holding that that town hall?
Oh, right.
Over Stockwell.
For the mayoral election, yes.
Right. So anyway, our A story here is Brian and his ball. So it's been a while since we had a Babylon opening.
Yes, it feels very like this is
season one.
let's have that party music, everybody's dancing, having a great time.
Hunky guys dancing in terrible underwear. I didn't like those undies at all. I've never been a big fan of those tidy whiteys, but I'll take it in a Queer as Folk episode.
They've got to just, they have to be a specific cut to really look sexy. Otherwise, they look so utilitarian that it's not sexy at all. It doesn't work for me.
I think I probably said this in season one, but underwear has come a really long ways since the show was airing. Now we have all kinds of crazy underwear. And
I mean, stuff that is like, it's just a banana hammock that attaches to one side and thongs, and there are like ties. There are just
lots of straps and webbing. And
the possibilities really are endless when it comes to underwear. It's insane.
So Vic appears, seemingly back from the dead. And I love seeing him again. He died 2 episodes ago.
And yet here he is. Hi, Jack Weatherall. How are you?
Yeah, back again.
It was like the first of many literary references that I noticed in the episode. So he's sort of the Jacob Marley to Brian Scrooge.
Oh, it's funny you say that because I wrote down that he was offering Brian 2 choices from basically a Stephen King novel, which was Get Busy Living or Get Busy Dying.
Yes. He said, if this is your heaven, this must be my hell.
Yeah. And then that awkward cut to the older generation dancing. I was aghast at the older gentleman dancing in the same tidy whiteys. I was like really freaked out by that.
There are granddaddies out there that can absolutely get it. But here, I think they were clearly making a commentary in the way Brian sees the older generation.
I did like how they dropped in YMCA. They're also, it's like, I mean, because we need to portray old. So Brian is back and continues telling everyone that he was at Ibiza for a party.
Yes, we all remember Barcelona.
Barcelona. I looked up the name of Brian's testicle procedure. I think last episode I called it a testiclectomy or something.
Yes, a made-up term that we could buy is true.
It's called an orchidectomy, like an orchid, but I don't understand why. It's like, what do balls have to do with an orchid?
It may just be in biology, there are male and female flowers. Like pollination is basically sex. Like that's what they call it. That's why they call it the birds and the bees, basically. So maybe that's why.
Well, apparently most men go back to work after 2 weeks after having their orchidectomy, having their testicle removed. Ooh. And this was a little interesting because Brian was like completely wrecked by this procedure. So I think he's still within that 2 week window of being in a little bit of ouchy pain.
I think they tried to sell it off like he had partied too hard while in Ibiza.
Yeah. he partied until he lost his ball.
He had a ball. Did love that moment with the nurse that woke him up.
Mr. Kinney. You're in recovery. How do you feel?
I'm having a ball.
Okay, good. Nice to know that his sarcastic humor is still intact.
I would love to wake up from surgery and be that witty. It's like you got to have some material ready or something.
Exactly. I mean, I haven't had surgery in a very long time, but I'm pretty sure I was much more like a...
You were hilarious.
Kind of sad. I couldn't think of a witty retort to the nurse.
There's a kind of a weird location scouting thing that happened here. This was when Brian drops Justin off at the Pittsburgh Institute of Fine Art, but it looked like the loading dock of the Pittsburgh Institute of Fine Art.
Let him outside the back.
Well, the only reason why we knew it was as because there was like a hastily printed sign on the wall that clearly didn't match. Like
that
the
green sign with all the really faded like concrete around it.
But one thing about this scene I really liked though is I loved hearing Brian say, "I missed you," to Justin.
By the way, I missed you.
Prove it. You're gonna have to do better than that.
I don't remember him saying anything like that before. I thought that was cute.
This will get into what I really start to like about what the series did with Brian. Is that I think they finally are making him into a more complex character rather than that Superman that we saw in the very first episode. And I this is where I get really excited for Brian's journey.
He's kind of like actually a Superman now, though. He's Rage.
Oh, yes.
Well, Justin starts to notice that Brian is a little off. I consider Justin to be one of the smartest characters on the show, except for that weird pink posse arc, that is.
Yes.
It was clever writing for him to start to pick up on something being not quite right with Brian, but I wish it would have played out longer. As it was, he noticed one thing and then overheard the voicemail from Brian's doctor, and it's like, oh, I know what's up.
Yeah, that was something that I was really surprised at in what the episode was portraying, and that Brian seems to still have managed to keep the surgery a secret from everyone. In one way, Vic's death really helped him out because it offers one hell of a cover-up. Everyone is too consumed with the fact that we've lost Vic and Debbie's still not doing well, and that has Michael's attention and everyone off of Brian. So Brian's able to kind of quickly sneak off, get a ball cut out, and come right back in.
How long do you think he was gone? Like a long weekend or?
That's what they make it seem like. And that helps your theory considering how he acts in like that meeting where he looks like he's still in a lot of pain and how he's handling being around people, and that he probably tried to join the living much sooner than he was told to.
Well, I wish that this story would have been extended for dramatic impact where like Justin could have been sort of like something's seriously wrong with Brian and I don't know what. Type of thing where there's a bigger gap than like 30 seconds of him thinking, something's wrong with Brian. Let me listen to the voicemail to like something's wrong with Brian. A week passes. He starts to notice more and more and more. He loops in Michael, but the phone call just immediately told him what was up.
Brian, you want me to get the phone?
Hello, Mr. Kinney. This is Dr. Rabinowitz from the John Hopkins Oncology Center. I'd like to discuss your post-surgery options, so please give me a call at 410-555-4832.
I mean, first of all, I think that all that voicemail violates all HIPAA. Because I'm pretty sure they can't. I mean, unless I think you probably agreed to it. That doctor should have been like, hi, I'm calling for, please give me a call back. Done.
I think I think that is like a checkbox these days, isn't it? It's like, we'll tell you in my chart or
yes.
Check this box if it's okay to leave you a voicemail.
So. Yes, that, I mean, that is true. I mean, I think that's what I do when I go to the doctor is I just say, you can just leave me a voicemail. But it's different now because we all have cell phones. Here he has a machine that like anybody can listen to on his landline.
Like Justin.
Like Justin, who so happens to not be in the shower when the doctor calls and he's able to hear everything. But like there's your point, though, about having something more something of more substance in the dramatic arc, in that we don't see the confrontation that Justin could have with Brian right then and there.
Right.
We have to wait until the end of the episode, which is kind of strange.
And Brian's pretty stupid. He went to all this trouble to like hide his surgery. The answering machine didn't occur to him.
Right. He manages to concoct a whole story about him going across the ocean and back. Right. And everyone seems to buy that. Done like, in by that, that's darn, just Brian. That darn answering machine.
I think that Justin should have confronted Brian over this instead of going to Michael. And I thought this was super weird.
Yes. Because yes, I agree.
Brian and Justin's relationship has come far enough now that they don't need Michael's input on their own problems. So instead, he calls the hospital. He finds out who Dr. Rabinowitz is, the oncologist. And then he goes straight to Michael.
Did you know? Huh? Did you know?
Know what?
About Brian.
As if to say, like, there's still some sort of secret thing happening between Michael and Brian.
Yeah, yeah. He phrased it that way, too, as in, like, Michael surely must have known. Michael must be keeping this from me.
So then he reveals this medical information. Like, that's the thing I still can't get over, because I'm like, Justin, that's not something for you to just blurt out to someone.
Yes, discretion, young man.
There was a message from a Dr. Rabinowitz on his machine, checking up on his surgery and to discuss follow-up treatment. So I called the hospital to see who Dr. Rabinowitz is, and he's an oncologist who specializes in testicular cancer.
Like, this is that moment where we still understand how young Justin is and how much
how old is he kinda, now? Is he like 20?
To me, that's still pretty young.
Especially good when, point.
when you're dealing with someone who is, you know, obviously older, has had more life experiences and how to handle situations like this. That's where I feel like we still understand that his youthfulness kind of comes to the forefront before he takes a step back and rethinks, like, okay, how do I confront this? Instead, I'm just going to go to his best friend and give him shit for it.
Well, Michael being like 10 years older than Justin gives the worst advice ever.
Well, I'm sure if he wanted us to know, he would have told us.
What are we supposed to do? Just keep our mouths shut, act like we don't know anything?
That's what he wants. And that's exactly what we're gonna do.
He says that he loves Brian enough to honor his wishes, but Brian never overtly expressed that wish, and there are certainly times when ignoring wishes like that for the good of the other person just makes sense.
The other side of that coin is Michael, I think, is trying to go through the growth of not inserting him into every situation like that. Because, you know, when we first met Michael, like, his whole thing was butting into Brian's life so because he didn't want to be left out.
Right.
You know, because of his unrequited love for Brian. And here he's been able to like kind of remove himself from that situation. Like, he could have done the much more mature thing, which is, I'm not getting involved until Brian wants me to.
Yeah.
But, you know, then we get to that when they run into it, when they see each other at Babylon.
Oh, I've got all kinds of problems with this scene.
Oh, I'm very excited. You know what? I'm going to open the floor to you.
So, okay, to set the stage, Babylon the next night, there's a Wet Willy contest. It's like, okay, I was down for that.
I mean, do you remember the shower contest?
Yeah, that's what I was going
to
say.
And then they moved it to Charlie's, and now I don't know if it's still a thing or not.
There was the wet boxer contest at Roscoe's also, and I like that one too.
I would have liked that more than the shower one.
It was like anything where our friends and bar acquaintances are taking their clothes off and being sprayed with water. It's like, we're down for that, right?
Yeah, and like the shower thing was always like they're just going to get drenched, but this wet willy contest was very specific.
Yeah, well, she kind of had like one of those cat sprayers, and she would just kind of come up and squirt, squirt, squirt the willy.
And you would be like, so, back, back.
Yeah, it was literally a wet willy contest. Nothing else got wet. But okay, so my problem with this is Brian runs off with the winner of the wet willy contest. What exactly was he going to do with this guy in his current state? Because he's definitely not going to get blown, right?
Correct.
And topping seems out of the question. Absolutely. Much banging around there. So why was Brian like chasing after this guy and hitting on him when he couldn't do anything with him?
I think it was more because Justin was wanting to get out of Babylon, like go home. And you have Michael who is trying to be clever and saying that like, we would have missed you. Like without fully saying like, oh, I know what you did. Or like, I know what happened.
I know what you did last summer.
Right. Exactly. What are you waiting for? And then there was also that introduction of the film director at the, also at, Babylon's.
Oh, I've got problems with him too.
So yeah, I don't know if that was just like, he's like, oh, I'm going to go talk to the winner. And that was just his escape.
But it looked like he wanted to like bag the guy. Maybe it's like, just like habit, like yes, muscle memory. Like,
inevitably that's where it should go. But then like, can you imagine if he was like going to go to the back room of Babylon and then like, just before they go there, he stops and saying, wait a minute, I can't. And then he walks away. Wait, can you imagine?
Wait, I'm not equipped.
Right.
So back at the loft, Justin gets all mama bear with Brian and he's like helping him get out of his clothes and things like that. This was the moment that I thought Justin should have said, Brian, I heard the voicemail. I'm here for you. We can get through this together. Instead, he bursts into tears on Brian's chest as Brian like falls asleep. This is your moment, Justin. This is your time to be intimate with your partner on an emotional level.
But he doesn't take it. He just sort of like lets the feelings out. Again, maybe this is that youthfulness that like he's never been confronted with this kind of discussion and doesn't know how to frame it without it making it seem that he's intruded on something that is very private to Brian. And so he still doesn't know how to acknowledge it or how to bring it up. It
just seems like the root cause of this is this shouldn't be something that you really keep to yourself or keep from your partner. I can relate to it, but at the end of the day, you're going to need their help, right?
Yep.
And who better to give it than that person?
Alas, that's just not the Brian we know.
And Justin's going to find out at some point. I mean, he explores Brian's balls. So.
Right. He's going to notice something is missing.
Or maybe they put the fake one in right away. Do you think they take the old one out and then shove that fake one in right away? It seems like that would be like a follow-up.
Yeah.
Like after you heal.
Or would they... This may require more research into like how they deal with the prosthetic. Like does the prosthetic go in right away? Because would you want to put them through another surgery? So it's like recovery, then another surgery, then another recovery.
So Brian and Michael have a picnic on the floor of the loft, and I love those scenes.
Yeah, it's always Chinese. They're always getting high.
Yeah, I love that. I love seeing that. I want to do that. I could be so lucky as to have Michael Novotny as a BFF. But Michael just can't help himself and spills the beans right after telling Justin, like, no, it's what Brian wants. And he's just out with it without really any coaxing.
I know. I know you didn't go to Ibiza. I know you went to Johns Hopkins. And you had surgery for, oh God.
Do you think it was a mix of like alcohol and
weed?
And weed? Or is there still some of what he's harboring about what happened with Vic and he's still in a somewhat emotional state that he just couldn't help the idea of he's already lost his uncle. Imagine losing his best friend.
I think that we are expected to believe that he was so overwrought over the fact that he could possibly lose Brian that he just couldn't help himself. But all of this could be avoided if Brian was just honest about this and said, yeah, I have a 99.5% chance of survival if they just take my ball out. I'm going to be okay, Michael. Don't worry about it.
That would be asking the writers of this show at this point to offer some subtlety, and I don't think that's really in the cards for
them. That's true.
But yeah, like that, I still thought that Hal Sparks' performance in that scene was really lovely and very tender. I was very, very moved by it, actually.
What I didn't like about this whole thing is when Brian kicked Justin out.
Why didn't you tell me?
Maybe because I didn't want you to know. Or maybe because it's none of your fucking business.
Brian, I'm your partner.
Not anymore. I don't want you here. Now get the fuck out.
Cut it out.
I said get the fuck out.
Brian, I love you and I want to help you.
Get the fuck out!
Don't. Jesus.
Woo. He throws him the hell out.
Yeah, that was so harsh, but the note I wrote is, it's keeping in Brian's character, but I was going to list this as at the end as one of my misses, but then it really started to resonate with me because any decrease in Brian's superpowers or human frailty evidence would cause Brian to like have an existential crisis, yes. Which is what we saw. One question about this, though, is why Michael didn't suffer a similar fate. It seems like this shouldn't have been all on Justin, especially because he was doing his best to carry on as if nothing had happened.
I'm wondering if it's because Michael found out through Justin. So Brian doesn't want to discredit Michael for something that got revealed to him by Justin, perhaps.
Michael just seemed very scot-free on this one.
Maybe also because of his emotional state, Brian wasn't ready to throw him out.
There's something else that came up, which is just a few episodes ago, there was that GoFundMe for Brian to cover the cost of his anti-Stockwell ad.
Oh, yes.
Brian accepted help then, and very graciously, I might add. So why did he flip out this hard on Justin trying to help him?
It's a good question. I mean, the fund to help with the campaign is sort of dealt with like the material lifestyle that Brian leads and him not having that. But when it came to his life, it felt like that's a much more private thing. It is strange. It's strange to know what was the root cause of him flipping out so hard over something like this from someone who's like, I just care about you. And I wish you could have felt comfortable enough to let me know. And I could have been there for you. And said, get the hell out.
Yeah, and takes his DVDs that he brought over to watch and like throws them down the stairs. It's like, dude, it's like, whoa.
Oh, like, did you catch the title? Some of the titles that.
No, Brian, what were they?
One was Terms of Endearment, which deals with, you know, cancer. I'm trying to remember the second one, but like they both dealt with cancer patients.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah. I would have thrown them out too. Maybe that was the missing link in the scene. Maybe we needed to know very clearly that Justin shows up with all these like cancer movies.
Well, no, I don't think that's what he showed up with. That was Brian throwing out titles when he said, here are the DVDs, which honestly, I thought Justin got them porn, but.
That would have been great. Let's stay in.
Right. I went through the beads in the back room and got these DVDs for us.
Still Queers, folks, stick around. We got a lot more to talk about tonight. B story tonight is Justin and Michael. So Ben, Michael, and Hunter are on bikes. I commented a few episodes ago about how unsteady Ben and Michael are on the bikes, two actors. They just cannot like look comfortable on two wheels. We find out that Michael and Justin are going to meet with a Hollywood director, Brett Keller.
Yes. And
something I wanted to draw attention to here is that Hunter asked for an autographed picture of Cameron Diaz.
Can you give me an autographed picture of Cameron Diaz? She's fucking hot.
Would you rather have one of Leo or Toby?
Later.
Hey, learn something.
This was a kind of an important Easter egg, not Easter egg, breadcrumb for something that's going to come up. And I was really surprised to see it in this episode, because normally the writers don't give us too much foreshadowing. But take note of this moment, because it's important.
Okay.
Oh, you don't know what I'm talking about, do you?
No.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, maybe this will be a surprise just for me as well. So I'm excited.
Yeah. Hunter hooks up with Cameron Diaz later on. Just kidding.
But like, also, like, what a way to mark the cultural moment in the series. Like, Cameron Diaz was the hot woman, you know, Tobey Maguire and Leonardo DiCaprio, like, still being in the conversation. Like, how early 2000s can you get?
Is Tobey Maguire still around?
Yes, but not nearly as prevalent. Leo is apparently the enduring actor of our time, which is great.
I loved him in Wolf of Wall Street. I thought he was so good.
I didn't care for The Revenant. Wolf of Wall Street should have been his Oscar performance. Him,
that dance he did at the wedding was amazing.
His scene while being on Quaaludes is hands down one of the funniest things I've ever seen in film. That was some genius. And also Jonah Hill should have won the Oscar for that too. That was an incredible Jonah Hill performance. I never would have expected it from him.
I love that movie.
It's, yeah, it's so great. It's like, it's so excessive for all the right reasons. It's great. But I want to bring up this meeting that they have with Brett Keller.
Brett Keller, played by Michael Cera. He appeared in 5 episodes of the show.
So this scene, it reminded me very strongly of one of my absolute favorite plays. One I actually directed in college. It's called The Little Dog Laughed. And this particular scene, like, you could have easily have lifted this scene from the play because there is a scene that they call in the play called He Meeting Him. And it's all about an agent trying to get this playwright to let them option his play that is about two men in love for her movie star client who is also in the closet.
Wow, that's a lot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's all sorts of business that happens in this play, and it's a wonderful, wonderful play. But like this conversation that they're having, the way they're saying, like, it's great that you're interested in Rage, but let's all be clear, this is very much a gay superhero. He is having gay sex. He is gay, 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 gay. So how do we know that you're going to remain true to that, even as a gay filmmaker who we are told later is a sellout? Or,
right,
you know, so how are they able to ensure that their comic that is absolutely queer based will remain so? And the same thing happens in The Little Dog Laughed. Like, they make their promise that you will see that the film is a story of two men in love. And then as the play progresses, once they've gotten the option, they start to slowly pick apart at that. And like, we want to beef up the female character and tone down the sex stuff between the two guys, until by the end of the play, they have completely straightened the story.
There was something about this meetup at the Hip Bistro that I didn't like. And that was Michael dressed up for it in a tie. I thought that was really weird for a comic store owner turned comic book writer. I don't know why he would do that.
Well, he heard Hollywood director, therefore very important business meeting. Meanwhile, Brett Keller looks like he's fresh out of film school.
Yeah, right.
Like that was something I couldn't get over. And he's supposed to be the hip, hot new thing.
You know who Brett Keller reminded me of?
Who?
Bryan Singer.
Ooh. Oh,
I got that vibe off of him as we were watching this.
I'm going to keep that in mind as we see him in later episodes. I'm going to keep watching for that, because that is, I 100% see that.
Well, he doesn't get like kind of creepy the way that Bryan Singer allegedly got creepy, but there was just something about like the superhero director. There's something about the I'm Hollywood, I'm going to have parties stuff. And I was like, I wonder if this character is modeled off of him.
I immediately
thought that Brett Keller was really smarmy and annoying. that whole like Colin Farrell call during lunch, and Michael and Justin are just in awe.
Oh, I roll.
I didn't like that small town gee whiz. It's a movie star moment with them. It seemed fake to me.
Yeah.
And Michael, I can see acting that way, but Justin is usually pretty cool and collected and not much amazed by important people, I guess.
Yes, he manages to play it very cool. He's usually like able to very much hold his own no matter who the person is. I mean, he's able to be with Brian, who everyone thought was this untamable personality. And Justin has like figured out a way to not be fazed by it anymore.
And they get that riled up over Colin Farrell calling.
Right. I mean, then again, you know, Colin Farrell at that point was like that super hot hit boy with that Irish accent.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I guess this is 2005.
Yeah.
So the next meeting with Brett Keller is at Babylon for the Wet Willy contest that we talked about a few minutes ago. Much better underwear in this scene, by the way.
Yes.
Ben's response to Brett Keller was interesting.
You know, Ben's a writer, too.
Screenplays?
Books. Just finished a novel.
What's it about?
It's a love story between two men set in Paris in the 30s.
Period pieces are a tough sell.
I wasn't planning to sell it. Besides, I'm sure it's not your thing.
And what is?
Mindless entertainment for 12-year-old boys.
Jesus, Ben.
Oh, I'd like to hear what he has to say. Please, continue.
Well, considering you're gay and that you pretty much have the power to do anything you want, one would think you might do a project with some relevance. Social responsibility.
Is he jealous of Brett being interested in Rage, or does he really think that as a gay director that Brett has a higher moral obligation to the community? It wasn't clear to me at this point.
This is the flaw that I found in Ben's argument when he's talking about how he should be doing socially relevant media. I'm like, he's trying to option your partner's explicitly queer superhero comic book for mainstream. That's huge. That's like,
yeah.
And you're going to tell me that him taking that and putting it into a popular art form like film is not doing the socially relevant thing? I think that's because we didn't quite know the history behind Brett Keller at this point just yet, that it doesn't read as truthful. It's like, Ben, what you're arguing for him to do is exactly what he's trying to do. Like, why are you being pissy about it?
Yeah. It's like, calm down. and then there's also the notion that even if he did do something with the Rage comic and changed it up or something, the hundreds of thousands of dollars that Michael would get from his original script might make that a little more worthwhile.
Yeah.
And maybe get okay with that because it could like get the family out of debt or something.
Right. They could buy a place. Is Ben still teaching?
I don't know. Well, Michael really like flipped the fuck out and went for the jugular when he was telling Ben off.
You know, I may not be the brilliant, uncompromising genius that you are, but you know what I think? I think this has nothing to do with artistic integrity. I think that you're jealous because somebody wants to make a big movie out of our comic book and no one will touch your novel.
You could disagree with somebody without being like completely destroying them.
Oh man, he hits that nerve when he says like, you're just jealous that no one's interested in your book. I'm like,
yeah, he went from 0 to 60. Ooh. Like, ah, bam. The thing I didn't understand or like about this scene is that little pissy argument that they had about Brett Keller was enough for Michael to leave Ben and his foster son and spend the night at Ted's place without telling anybody where he's going.
Crashing on the couch for the night.
Yeah, that's enough to do it. I mean, like at the beginning of, was it this season? Michael ran off with Hunter and risked it all. Now he just abandons him?
Right. Over one little fight.
Yeah. It's like, whoa, kind of overreacting again there.
It's like, or uses as a teachable moment and maybe.
Yeah.
Show how you can handle a disagreement and come to an amenable conclusion.
Yeah, it didn't rise to the level of I'm not coming home tonight and I'm not telling right. you where I am. It's like, okay, you could have come home and slept on your own goddamn sofa, not on like Ted's. Ted's meth sofa. And speaking of that, is Ted all of a sudden is giving great advice here, but he, like, four episodes ago, he's a crystal queen. He's like
getting gang banged on camera. Like,
yeah, all of a sudden he's the sage one. It's like, wow,
that is what rehab can do for you.
That's what Blake Wyszecki can do for you, right?
Oh, I miss Blake.
Hold on a few more episodes.
Oh, yeah.
Still queer as folk. There's more on the way. So we had two runners in this episode. Debbie is out Tombstone shopping for Vic. Did you notice the amazing poncho that Emmett had on?
Yes. Oh my God. loved that yes. poncho moment for Emmett. Everything about that was right.
So Debbie picks the solid marble headstone for the everyday low price of $47,000 and then decides that she's got to work herself to death in order to pay for it.
Yeah. She says, what? I'm going to cash in on my retirement savings and I'll, you know, get another mortgage on the house and I'll pick up extra shifts at the Liberty Diner.
That'll take a long time to get 47 grand.
I'm sorry, but picking up a couple of shifts at a diner is not going to really help you pay thousands of dollars for this insanely ornate headstone.
I loved her line, though, when she picked it up.
This is for my brother, and it's my money, and I can spend it any goddamn fucking way I choose. Wrap it up.
Wrap it up.
That's the one I want. Wrap it up. I did like seeing Debbie curating her button collection. Oh. I thought that was really a nice interstitial scene where she is getting ready to re-engage in her career as the mother of Gayopolis, Liberty Avenue, Liberty Diner, and she has to pick the right buttons for it.
Just the right amount of flair.
Yeah, I thought that was a really nice piece of staging there.
Right, it's, you know, something that she's known for. Like, that was the first time we ever saw her was in that full getup. And so, yeah, it's a great way to sort of reintroduce the character after all this.
Something that I wondered about is how much time do you think Debbie has taken off after Vic died? How much time passed between his death and now? Is this, like, are we only in a couple days or are we in weeks?
Oh, I think this is still very fresh. Because I know clearly she has not fully gone through all of the stages of grief. Because we haven't seen her get to acceptance, I think, yet. That's why she's spending so much money on this headstone and like still trying to. It's that whole thing like what she did when she did the Christmas in July. Like she's still in some way trying to make it up to Vic for not being there.
So Horvath is back, or as you called him, Have a Bath, in one blooper reel that we did.
But he returns. It's great.
He's back. We haven't seen him since season 3, episode 13, and that one was Tweaked Out, Fucked Out, Crystal Queen.
Yes.
That was when Hunter collected the condom of jizz from the murderer.
Oh, yes.
Fun fact. Carl is really nicely charming when he stopped by to ask Debbie out for a bite to eat. Emmett was overjoyed at that, so yes. It's reinforcing that Debbie's still struggling with Vic's death, and she said no. She says she declined Horvath, which I don't know, I thought that was an interesting choice that the writers made. I didn't think it was a bad one or a good one. It was interesting that she said no, that she was going to stew over this a little bit longer.
Yes, and then it gives us that really wonderful scene between Emmett and Horvath.
So slow down. I'm not following.
The point is, Carl, no one can get through to her, not me, not Michael. Something tells me, sure as I know there's a shirt in your closet that's a better match for those polyester pants than the one you got on, that you can. Time like this, girl needs a man.
A girl needs a man is what Emmett said. That sounds like a pretty thin reason, though. But maybe it was all that was needed to introduce Carl back into the story.
It doesn't take much.
Yeah. There was a moment that I really wanted to mention is that Sharon Glass carried that scene at her first shift in the diner without any dialogue. Ugh. So after she talked to Vic's friend, there's no more dialogue. It's all physical.
Yes, let's talk about Vic's friend.
Yeah, who was that guy?
His name was, well, here's the thing. His name was Harold.
Harold.
And it feels like he comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Interrupts her during the shift. and puts her in an extremely fragile emotional state. And what I couldn't get over was the fact that that headstone she was looking at was the Archangel Gabriel, the herald.
Oh.
And I'm like,
interesting.
Because, like, for me, like, as this guy was talking, it's like, first of all, who are you?
Who are you?
Where'd you come from? Who gives you the right to just, like,
why wasn't it Rodney?
Yes, like that was the crazy thing. So the fact that it was someone who was clearly there, it felt almost a spiritual moment, because then we don't see this guy ever again.
Right.
So yeah, I felt like there was some sort of connection there that was playing out.
So for once, I liked when Horvath showed up. I liked that somebody didn't call first. <'Cause> you know how we're always commenting about people just show up
yes.
at other places, like knock knock, hello. It was a lovely scene with Debbie and Carl in the kitchen together. I guess in the end, Carl really was the only one that Debbie could have talked to about this, because Carl had gone through this with his first wife. I thought that Carl might have talked a little too much about himself there. It's like when somebody else is having problems, you want to keep your end of it to a minimum. Uh-huh. Not say, oh, well, this reminds me of my ex-wife that I watched die. And let me tell you a story in about 10 minutes. It's like, let her go.
Yeah, I guess I have to agree with that. Like I understood that he wanted to probably try and offer himself as, I know what you're going through. I understand how this kind of grief works and how it can consume you. And, you know, and he's trying to be that shoulder for her. But yeah, he does talk a lot about himself.
Right. Which like, was, you know, it's okay. I mean, the story, it was important to the story, but it's like, this is about Debbie. It's like, we don't care about you and like a character that never appeared on the show.
Yeah, right? Like give the indication to her that I know exactly what you're going through because I went through it with my wife. I understand this grief. Now you go.
Right. Exactly. I will now listen for the next 2 hours.
Maybe this will be the pathway for Horvath to stay longer than he did.
Our second runner of the show is Lindsay. So Sam Auerbach, artist extraordinaire, shows up at Lindsay's gallery. And this character is a very well-written scoundrel. He's vulgar and gross. He's hitting on Lindsay. And I like where this story's going. It's an interesting story for this show.
I was just about to sell that.
It's a sentimental piece of horseshit.
Miranda, put her over there on the table, honey.
Girl. Now give me a ham and cheese on rye.
If anybody knows about titties and behinds, it's you.
Whoa, easy, killer. Don't want another pop and the kisser.
Oh, don't tell me it still hasn't healed.
Actually, I just wore it so you'd feel sorry for me.
I hate it so much.
That's why I think it's great for the show.
Like the fact
this
that
guy shows up and you're just like, ugh.
The fact that she's still dealing with this lecherous artist, and I just thought this guy is just so damn gross.
Oh, I know.
But it's to the point where I think his like machismo is so overplayed that it becomes a caricature. Like, oh, I get it. He's a disgusting man.
Mr. Man.
Right. Like I get it. And because he's again so overplayed that I feel like it does a big disservice to Lindsay and Melanie as characters in this show.
Well, the next thing I had was dinner with the Dykes.
Exactly. She then invites the guy to her house.
Yeah. This was an interesting chess game, though, because Lindsay knows what Sam is all about. And she knows that he's pursuing her. Melanie has no clue. And she's hyping Lindsay's work as an artist and everything. And as a viewer, knowing that Melanie is headed for a bad outcome in this situation was great drama. I love these situations where we, as the audience, know more than a character does. We see the bus headed that way up in the attic. By the way, it's like, I guess Lindsay gave up art because the attic is pretty much mothballed.
Yeah.
Now. It's like
right,
bags and everything dropped.
All that renovation to make it her studio. Right.
The blocking in the attic scene was excellent. Lindsay and Sam had this kind of dance going on around Melanie. And Melanie has no clue what's going on. And so I thought that the story and the blocking was really nice there.
I, because I know where this storyline goes, this is where I find that the show really does a disservice to two of its three female characters. And I really cannot stand it.
So how did Lindsay end up back at Sam's hotel room anyway? All of a sudden, this story was like a Harvey Weinstein hotel room scene.
Oh my God.
What was she doing there?
I don't know.
They had dinner.
Yeah, I'll go back to your hotel room for the nightcap. And what is he? Not only does he get naked in front of her, then also to like light up that cigar and say, draw something. I'm like, oh, yeah. Get the well, he fuck did have that, over yourself.
He had a very funny line that Lindsay played well. Sam says, don't stand there gawking, draw something. Then Lindsay immediately gulps down her entire whiskey. Like, I thought that was hilarious because she's like, whoa, it's like, I need a drink.
Yes. If I'm going to look at a penis this long.
So Melanie is glad that Sam is inspiring Lindsay, but it's curious to me why she just wouldn't tell Melanie that he's aggressively pursuing her. There's something missing in this story. Like all of a sudden it becomes like their secret, but for no apparent reason.
Right.
I get, mm-hmm. Are we supposed to believe that Lindsay is like into it or something like that? And that's why she's keeping it secret?
Yeah, and this is what I'm getting to my point and how I feel like the series then does a disservice to its lesbian characters. Like she's going through, you know, she shows the portrait that she's done and the scene ends with her looking at it and sort of like giggling like she's a little schoolgirl looking at this man that she drew. And I'm like...
It was weird.
What are you? I'm going to get frustrated the more we talk about this particular storyline. So listeners, I'm sorry, but you're going to hear a lot of grunting from me and exasperation. Well, and
it's either the next episode or one after that. This becomes like one of the A stories. So yeah. That's going to be a fun episode to record. Okay. So we're changing up what we used to do, which were hits and misses to...
tops and bottoms.
Yeah, that's Matt's contribution there. So tops are good, bottoms are bad. Wait a minute, is there a flaw in our logic here?
Yes, because we don't want to typecast the positions as good and bad.
So let's think of it as metaphors. It's like at the top of our list are the following points, and at the bottom of our list, and it's just a double entendre.
We have that, listeners? Great.
Shall I talk about my tops first?
Yes.
Okay. I've got two tops.
It's too easy. Go on.
Okay. Top number one. I like the end credit song. It was called Attitude and it was by Suede. I love that song. And so it's an easy top. Second top was Emmett's wardrobe was just amazing. In every scene, he was wearing an amazing outfit and his clothes were beautiful. So hat tip to Patrick Antosh. He's the costume designer.
Costumed perfectly in this episode.
Yeah, I don't know where this came from all of a sudden. It was just like Emmett's just like, bam, like on point.
Working
everyone.
It all out. We love it.
What were your tops?
I went ahead and just pulled one top from here. And I would say that it's, where we finally start to see vulnerability in Brian through his diagnosis and surgery. We're seeing someone who is starting to acknowledge the good in his life. And I think that's that moment with Justin when he says, I missed you. We're starting to see that veneer start to become, you're able to mold it to where he can possibly accept this kind of love. And I think that's really lovely.
That's a good one. I feel bad for picking two easy ones for my tops. Okay, I have one bottom. Michael getting so worked up over Ben throwing shade. This was an extra thread in an episode that was already like really richly woven with emotions and drama. And Michael, quote, leaving Ben just didn't need to be a part of it, especially because they get back together like in the same episode, like not 5 minutes of screen time later. And Ben's jealousy pretty much never surfaces again. So it was kind of like a filler scene or filler content for me. So I didn't think that that really needed to be quite so heated and dramatic.
My bottom, and it's going to be a bottom throughout possibly the rest of this season, is this idea that the series is trying to sell that Lindsay is being charmed by Sam. He's such a disgusting
person. She's being stalked.
Stalked. Yes, she is being aggressively pursued by this person, and I credit her with a lot more. I think she would be much more savvy to navigate this. They're like, we think she is like like a step ahead of him in his game, but we all know that finding that out later, that is not the case. And so, yeah, it's a huge bottom for me.
Well, do you remember that Melanie had actually encouraged her to like use her womanness?
Yes,
on Sam.
That is true. But Lindsay should have more brains than this.
Yeah, agreed. This has been episode 8 of season 4, Two Kinds of Lies. Next time on Still Queer as Folk, we cover episode 9, and it's called Have Some Balls. Balls.
Have a ball.
That episode starts a great storyline for Emmett and a professional footballer.
Yes.
Looking forward to that one.
Okay. Very excited. We could really use some fresh reviews and ratings on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to us. So please take a moment and help us out. We really appreciate it. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF and on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
And you can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall if you'd like to connect with me directly.
And you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at MatthewPD.
Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me tonight. Come back next week for a fresh episode. Really enjoyed having you with us tonight. Still Queer as Folk was recorded with love